Good morning and welcome to this February 5th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we're always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, however you listen to your podcasts. We are under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook under Writers on Writing, and you can follow Barbara at penonfire.com. You can follow me at mariestone.com. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We are diving deep into journalism for the full hour this morning. William Wheeler is a writer and producer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Time, Foreign Affairs, The New Republic, McSweeney's Quarterly, Playboy, and elsewhere. His reporting has won numerous awards, and his documentary, Who Shot the Sheriff?, a film about the Cold War assassination attempt on Bob Marley, was nominated for an Emmy. His documentary, The Trade, a series about human trafficking, premiered at Sundance Film Festival last week. Bill's work stretches across South Asia, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and the U.S. He's covered the Libyan refugee crisis and the fault lines of the EU, the rise of Europe's far right, the radicalization of Danish jihadists, and the murder of a Honduran environmentalist. He was a part of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting team that won the National Press Club and Society of Professional Journalists Award for the coverage of the rebuilding effort in Haiti, and his feature from Pakistan on geopolitical tensions over the Indus River won a Earth Journalism Award for the Copenhagen Climate Summit. Bill holds graduate degrees in international affairs and journalism from Columbia University. He's also the host of the podcast Detours, Conversations with Global Storytellers. State of War, MS-13, and El Salvador's World of Violence is his first book. It's published by Columbia Global Reports. And I will mention now that for locals who are listening live, Bill is appearing tonight, February 5th at 5 o'clock p.m. at Laguna Beach Books for a discussion and signing of this book. So if you want perhaps an even more detailed account of the book and a meet and greet, Laguna Beach Books tonight at 5 o'clock. Bill, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Yeah. So that was an internally long introduction, but and we have the full hour, but we weren't going to get to all of that, so I wanted to kind of get that out there. But I thought we could start by talking about your path into journalism and how, you know, everything that I just outlined there, all that happened, because I know you entered the field at a tough time, so maybe you can kind of walk us through how that happened.
Sure. I mean, I was not on the student paper. That was never kind of, didn't really appeal to me. And by the time I got to Berkeley, where they had an amazing student paper, I didn't even really know how to get involved in that if I wanted to. But I always wanted to do foreign reporting. And the path to doing that was increasingly, you know, opaque. But that also came with some freedoms. And so I think there was... the idea of the latter, to becoming a foreign correspondent, used to be that you would get a job at the Associated Press and you would kind of make friends with the foreign editor and cover, you know, Iowa for a couple years or what have you, and then try to get yourself a posting abroad. I could kind of see the writing on the wall and knew that wasn't really an option that seemed to be, you know, worth investing all of the time and resources in. So I started at the local paper and the Orange County Register and covered weeklies and did all that kind of stuff. But after that, I decided to just sort of break and go out to Columbia University and to grad school and then to just take off and do it. And so in the
summer...
What
year was this?
2006, I went and I did a dual degree. So I had a year at the journalism school and a year at the international affairs program. And in between, Lebanon sort of beckoned to me. I was looking at the Middle East and trying to decide where to go, Egypt or Syria. And there had just been a war in Lebanon the summer before with Israel. And there was a war that broke out there kind of after I decided to go for the summer, where a Palestinian camp had some Al-Qaeda splinter factions sort of entrenched in it, and the Lebanese army basically razed the whole community of tens of thousands of people in this, you know, knuckle duster battle with this jihadist group. And so that seemed interesting to me at the time. And I went up there and I actually got off the, I took a flight from New York to Beirut and my younger brother was on the flight and I got off and he took the flight back on to Addis Ababa to teach in rural Ethiopia for the summer. So that was kind of my first jumping into it. And then for years after that, I just sort of floated around the globe and I would pick the assignments that seemed interesting to me. And I'd usually go for a few months at a time and kind of dig in. Mm-hmm. Which was great to sort of learn how to do this immersive act to journalism. I had a lot of support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
When did that start?
Actually, so I went there my first summer in 2007, and then I wanted to come back and cover the aftermath of this battle and try to get to the bottom of what had happened. And so they gave me a grant in 2008, I believe, to go back and kind of do some poking around there.
But when you walked into Beirut, you just walked in. Kind of without an assignment and without any backing.
I had a alumni connection to the editor at the Daily, an editor at the Daily Star newspaper there, mm-hmm. and so I kind of contributed to that newspaper, and it was sort of a home that I landed in for a few months.
That's very cool. Is that a path you would recommend these days for people who are thinking about getting into journalism? Is the kind of grad school path, if you think, kind of the right road in?
No, I don't. I mean, I think maybe grad school, they say not to study journalism. Journalism school is never worth it financially, unless you get a full ride, and then it might be. I caution anyone going into journalism these days. The economics of it have sort of fallen out, and there's ways to make it work, but, it's a sort of labor of love, I think, and you have to think twice about whether you're going to go invest a lot of educational resources in that, I think.
Right.
I also think the Middle East is something I caution people about.
Right.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, to that point, can you talk a little bit about choosing your subject matters? It sounds like Beirut sort of spoke to you early on. And I'm kind of wondering if once you have a bulk of work out there, the subject matters start choosing you more than you choosing them. But kind of how you, and that'll lead us sort of into how you chose MS-13 here, but in general.
I mean, I was interviewing, I've got a friend who lives downstairs from me in Brooklyn, Damon Tabor, who wrote a piece, a talented writer who wrote a piece that became Cartel Land, the documentary. And I was interviewing him and he said, the subject sort of, I chase the subjects I chase for very selfish reasons. And I sort of, I identify with that. I think, he's always interested in like cartels and black markets and drugs, and mine have been a little bit more boring. I think what calls to me about a lot of stories that I did was this idea that the end of the Cold War sort of was going to usher in this new period of the end of history and free markets and an end to wars and sort of democratic peace dividends. And, everyone was going to be shiny, happy people holding hands. And I was drawn to the places that sort of tested that, where that didn't seem to be working. And so I was drawn to, whether we could rebuild Haiti better after the earthquake, or whether this Palestinian camp that had been allowed to sort of fester in marginalization and exclusion, whether there was a newfound capacity to look at some of these issues that had precipitated these cycles of conflict. So I think that's kind of, Libya, looking at Europeans kind of rushing to embracing militarism again in defense of humanitarianism and human rights, but unwilling to sort of shoulder the humanitarian consequences of that war in the flow of people that were fleeing. And so I was interested in places where the rubber meets the road and trying to understand what that said about, the way the world was turning.
It's really interesting because as I look across all the pieces you've done, they both seem very broad and very deep at the same time. Like they seem like there's a thematic link through a lot of them and, patterns keep replaying themselves. And we can talk about that in this book as well. But You can kind of see it in hindsight how you got to all the places that you got, but initially it probably felt maybe a little bit random to you about how
Yeah, or I think that maybe it was made sense to me, but not to anyone else.
Right. You know?
They certainly weren't like career resume builders, projects that I took on. You know,
I wouldn't say that. There's a it's just everyone is fascinating in its own way. But well, we could talk about this later too. But you know, it's a lot of the things that you've chosen are subject matters that I think a lot of people aren't aware of completely, and you have to bring your audience up to speed mm-hmm. while you're trying to deliver complicated.
Absolutely.
Nuanced, right. You know, information to them. But we'll talk about that in a minute. So let's talk a little bit about State of War and what it was about MS-13 and El Salvador that hit your radar.
Sure. I mean, you know, like I was in Europe and I had been chasing, I'd been Libyan civil war. And then afterwards, looking at how that country had sort of descended into violence and there was no sort of post-conflict security plan. And, you know, Europe was sort of reeling with, you could see these divisions setting in around the idea of burden sharing. You know, was Germany going to allow some of the refugees that were washing up on the shores of Italy and France to make their way north? Mm-hmm. And you could see the rise of populism, the sort of dark forces in Hungary and Greece that I was reporting on that were stoking these fears, and it looked in some ways like they were using the very familiar scapegoats of World War II. Mm. Jews, gays, gypsies, foreigners, you know, a very familiar cast of perceived enemies. I was interested in El Salvador because, it, you know, in 2012, we had, you know, in an 18-month period, we had 100,000 unaccompanied minors show up at the San Diego port of entry, and for the first time, Central Americans outpaced Mexicans as the primary country of origin for migrants showing up at the U.S., even though, you know, and when I say Central American, I mean Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And if you, the sum total of these populations is, you know, a quarter of Mexico's population, and yet there were so many people fleeing. So I was curious in, you know, how the U.S. was going to be affected by this crisis at its border that was in some ways analogous to the Syrian refugee crisis that was roiling Europe. And as Trump came into power, came into office, you know, it became very clear that he was, you know, he was inaugurated in January. In February, there were these two Department of Homeland Security memos that came out that, you know, critics called a blueprint for mass deportation. And you could really see how Trump has used the border crisis as such a central part of his messaging, as some part of his rationalization for why he needs to be reelected, sort of painting the hordes, the caravans, and the hordes of rapists and murderers at the border as a sort of barbarians at the gates. And so, you know, the more I knew a little bit about El Salvador, but like most people, I knew very little. And it struck me that people didn't realize that when we're talking about this border crisis, we're talking about a world on fire in a lot of ways, and so much instability. And we can talk about what that might mean or what's beneath that. But largely, I don't think people are aware that we're really talking about a particular crisis, acute crisis in Central America. And I don't think people have any idea of the U.S. role in precipitating some of the conditions that have bred this crisis. And so, you know, if you look back at El Salvador and the U.S.-backed civil war there, it became pretty clear to me that here was a chance to sort of bite into a story that speaks to the way that these boogeymen like MS-13 or Al-Qaeda arising after the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan in the 1980s or ISIS arising in the context of sectarian grievances by a Shiite government in Iraq, and whatever the next incarnation of that's likely to be as Trump turns his back on the Kurds and kind of leaves the region. We have these cycles of creating these boogeymen, both for political reasons and then, you know, sort of as after effects to our policies that we haven't really thought through or sold to the American public in a way that would engender follow through. So I was interested in how U.S. foreign policy creates these sort of crises and then walks away from them, and then they come back to haunt us.
Right. Over and over again. Mm-hmm. You said at some point that the book you set out to write turned into something very different than the book it became. And I was kind of curious what your initial original conceptions were about what the book was about versus what about it changed your mind.
Yeah. I mean, I think I went down to El Salvador thinking that, so a little bit of background on the Salvadoran Civil War. El Salvador was one of the most unequal societies on earth throughout the 1970s. I mean, really for 100, 200 years before that. And there were communist leftist ideologies and movements sweeping across the globe during the Cold War, and particularly Latin America, because of the unequal nature of a lot of these societies. And when war came to El Salvador, sort of provoked by a right-wing assassination of a priest, Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was a critic of the government's sort of human rights abuses and terrorist or torture and repressive approach, the U.S. sided with the right-wing government and started to send weapons and training and materiel to sort of pump up the right-wing government's military forces. And as a result, you had some of the worst abuses imaginable. You had villages like El Mazote, where 1,000 civilians were killed, massacred by machete by right-wing forces. I talked to somebody who was one of the investigators helping to exhume those corpses and said the average age was 7 years old of the victims.
Wow.
So you had Pandora's box with some really bad stuff going on. And you had a bunch of people wash up, leave, flee the war, and about 500,000 people come to Los Angeles. And, you know, some of these guys ended up sort of in the gang ecology of Los Angeles at that time. And then were eventually deported under Bill Clinton back to Central America, to these Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And so my initial thought was that that was really the onset of this gang crisis and the biggest factor, that it was these criminal deportations that Bill Clinton had begun, and every administration had sort of followed suit, you know, from Republican or Democrat. When I got down there, you know, the data sort of, I started to see all the other complexities. One of those major factors was the stuff that the Salvadoran government had done wrong. Mm. And so the Salvadoran government waged this very militarized response. And I talked to some of the people who had been involved in conceiving this Plan Mano Dura, the plan of the Iron Fist approach. And they said, look, it was just a publicity exercise. Like, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't have any real thought other than winning election. You know, we wanted to look like we were tough on the gangs, and that was kind of it. And in the process, they put, you know, tens of thousands of arrests. They put lots of young men into these prisons and sort of turned the prisons into finishing schools for organized crime. And the guys who came out of there, the gangs who came out of there, were something much, much more militarized, much more coherent. In the context of corruption, these gangs, the state has alternately waged war against them and sort of cut backroom deals with them as well, or members of the state. And so, you know, I started to see all the things that the Salvadoran government done wrong. And as the more I learned about it, the farther back into history I had to go. And so the book sort of starts in the present moment, and then it flashes back to Los Angeles and carries forward in time. And at the end of the book, I have to go back to the Civil War to understand that really the genesis of all this was, you know, this bloody conflict that traumatized an entire country, ejected a fifth of its population. And also, you know, the way that the story had been told journalistically, and the way that, you know, it had been spoken of in the U.S. by people who at least followed it during that time, was that, you know, this was a sort of stain on the U.S.'s, it was a parable of the Cold War, you know, sort of stain, another Vietnam, another Iraq. But that the U.S. in the end had helped bring peace and drafted this peace accord, and that that had basically ended the conflict. And what you start to see as you go into the details of that peace accord was actually they gave blanket amnesty to people from both sides who had been involved in kidnapping for ransom, who had been involved in, you know, these egregious human rights abuses by U.S. trained forces. And you can see how not just this period of dislocation and trauma, but the very provisions of the peace accord sort of opened the doors to corruption and relationships between corrupt and compromised members of security forces and the drug runners and the narco traffickers that have sort of since moved into the region and taken root. So, like anything, when you go into another country, you know, you have to sort of, you're born ceaselessly back to the past to understand the roots of these things. And the conclusion that I came away with is that El Salvador is still in a state of war, that, you know, the constituent groups may have changed, but if you look at the violence statistics in 2015, you know, they rivaled the most violent peak of the Civil War. And so the country's been in this sort of undeclared state of war ever since. We just told ourselves that the violence had ended.
Right. One of the things that I hadn't realized is how much the rhetoric coming out of the current administration is fueling MS-13's objective, that they love being promoted by our president. They love being told they're the evil boogeyman and how this is just helping them along, mm-hmm. and all the ways that this is helping them along. It's chilling.
Yeah, Alex Sanchez, one of the characters I talked to, was a sort of founding member, and now he does intervention with at-risk youth and tries to get people out of the gangs in Los Angeles. And he said, you know, Trump calls us animals. I knew somebody who called himself animal in the gang. You know, this is, you know, this is our branding, kind of. And now we're the boogeyman hiding behind around every corner in every small Midwestern town. It's sort of given a big PR boon to the gang.
Are there other examples of this when we've wielded our power in other countries and it's come back on our own soil to kind of haunt us in certain ways? This is the only kind of example that I can think of that, but there must be others. I'm sure it's happened in Europe, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. But it's come back to our own soul. I mean, I definitely think, you know, backing the insurgency against the Russians in Afghanistan in the 80s, you know, the Al-Qaeda was, you know, the name of the base that was given to the foot soldiers that bin Laden put together and could be relied on, you know, sort of as allies against the Russians. So arguably that washed back onto our shores.
Good point, right?
Yeah.
Good point. My guest this morning is Bill Wheeler. We are talking about the state of war, MS-13, and El Salvador's world of violence. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So how did you kind of, when you set out to write this, how did you start? Did you start with a lot of interviews, and then through those interviews you realized kind of the gaps in your knowledge and you went back to fill them in with history learning? Or
yeah, kind of. That's about right. Okay. I mean, I went down there thinking, you know, I wanted to get somebody who had been an OG in L.A., right, and could talk to the gang forming and then getting deported to El Salvador. I wanted to find somebody who had been this next generation of gangsters in El Salvador when the Salvadoran state came up with this Plan Monodura and started to wage war against them. And then, you know, I could see that there was, I think, kind of on the heels of this truce that had fallen apart. And the truce went down between 2012 and 2014, and it was still really murky, the circumstances surrounding that. But the gangs had come back, clearly had come out a different beast altogether. And so the story of the truce, as it was known, was that the government had, you know, encouraged MS-13 and these two formerly united factions of Barrio 18 to stop killing each other, and that, and they moved leaders from their separate prisons into the same, you know, minimum or medium security wing and allowed them to talk. And kind of overnight, the murder rate dropped in half. And the gangs had this new sophistication. They were giving press conferences, you know, all of a sudden. And they had, you know, like the idea that gang members in prison could give out orders that would be obeyed on the streets was sort of shocked people in El Salvador. And so this went on for about a year and a half. There were people questioning whether it was great to give gang members influence, you know, by simply murdering more or fewer people that they would, you know, have this political, this newfound political voice and traction. But when a new administration came in and basically cut off support for the truce, everything went to shit really quickly. Mm-hmm. And the gangs came back with weapons and arms, and they were using paramilitary tactics. So it was clear something else had happened. And so I decided I needed to find somebody from that period of time as well. That would be the third period that I was looking at.
That's crazy. As an armchair, you know, I don't know anything about anything. The number of gang members who were infiltrated in the police force and infiltrated, you know, I mean, the cross-contamination between these various factions that you, you know, the white hats and the black hats, all of the hats here are gray, right?
Right.
And how, like, what percentage of that do you think is true? Like, how many are purely gang members versus they have hats in both corners?
That's a good question. I don't really know. I think it's, look, I think the gang members are still, I think there's a danger in talking about the gangs like they're as sophisticated as like a Mexican drug cartel. Mm. Because I think the U.S. considers since 2012, considers MS-13 a transnational criminal organization like the Yakuza in Japan or the Gamora in Italy. And I think there's ways in which that's dangerous because you're still talking about a lot of guys without a high school education, you know, who are teenagers who only live in their neighborhoods and hide in their houses and text each other and surveil the community with, you know, with low level sort of, you know, seeing the apps they've got on their phones and the cameras that are all hooked up together. And so, when I try not to use terms like failed state mm-hmm. or failing mm-hmm. state because those bring to mind policy alternatives that are often militaristic. And I think that's been a big part of the problem in dealing with these gangs that are at root sort of a sociological phenomenon. You know, what is it about the culture of these large swaths of the country that don't have a lot of opportunities, that don't have a lot of economic development or infrastructure or ways out? My caveat is that I think a lot of these guys are just, you know, neighborhood guys that are trapped in these sort of armies. I think at the other hand, because there hasn't been any real effort to rehabilitate or, you know, change the life in these communities, the gangs have gotten very shrewd, and they've done it at the grassroots level, and they've done it since the truce by bartering, you know, with I talked to a cop who said, you know, when the leader of an imprisoned gang member can summon the chief of police to like demand that there are less raids in a particular zone, that really emboldened these guys. You know, they realize that they've got the power at the end of the day. So I think they're becoming something much more, you know, in terms of percentage of black or gray. I don't know, but it's trending toward the gray, I would say.
Yeah. It was certainly illuminating and surprising for me to hear about that. And tell me a little bit about getting these guys to talk, finding them, because you found people in a variety of different factions, you know, mm-hmm. the gang members and the investigators and all these. So talk a little bit about kind of finding the contacts and getting them comfortable enough to talk. Did they want to talk?
I mean, like, in because of the truce, I went to Honduras, and Honduras, I talked to a hitman who'd killed 150 people. And, you know, all he wanted to do was brag and talk about the way things were working there. It was tougher in El Salvador because of this truce, and there was a real sort of omerta around it. So you kind of use what resources at your disposal. I had a photojournalist I worked with who, you know, knew of one of these very few jobs programs where people were actually trying to get people out of the gangs. And so I found the character I call Manuel, who had found sort of wanted a way out and found a way out. So he, you know, I found there. Somebody else, you know, I went to the prisons, I was just fishing, mm-hmm. you know. And I talked to three people, and they weren't much use. And there was a fourth guy I was going to call it quits and walk away. I had another interview to do elsewhere. And this guy had been, I learned that he'd missed his lunch to wait and talk to me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to be diplomatic here and hear this guy out. And he was the one who had some of the most crucial information that sort of cracked open for me some of what was happening behind the scenes with this truce. And then I sort of pivoted and dug into that and found people who were firsthand observers. So it's a little bit like that. You know, you kind of go out fishing sometimes mm-hmm. and you get lucky. And then you have to have the instinct to sort of drill down. And now how do I, now that I've, you know, decided that this is my target, then that's where the real journalism starts, you know.
And you went out riding with these guys?
I went out, yeah, I did probably a week or two out on sort of combat patrols with mm-hmm. these elite anti-gang SWAT units. Mm-hmm. And none of that ends up in the book. But there was interesting things that happened there along those times, but they were sort of, you know, there was an instance where somebody had come and shot up some kids in front of a church. And, you know, as I went out there kind of patrolling around, we were sort of stalked by these two young guys who looked like, you know, the gangs, you think of the cover of the book has these guys in full facial tattoos. But they learned, you know, 2003 as the war, the state started gunning for them, that that made a great bullseye, you right. know. And so the new generation, you can't really tell. They're preppy and they look really preppy. But these two guys, I think, were gang members and they were following us. And there's kind of a cone of silence that followed. I was there at another, right on the heels of a shootout between the police and some gang members. And the statistics in my book, but there was, for one period of time, there was something like for every police officer killed in a gunfight, 55 gang members were. And it was a stat that a sort of crusading local online magazine, El Faro, published. And I think that speaks to the sort of freed hand and this in this war that the military and police have, this militarized police that's working in tandem with the army. And, you know, they're going in and shooting a lot of people up and killing a lot of people. And so I arrived right on the heels of one of these conflicts and sort of unpieced a little bit how that happens. None of that stuff made it into the book because I really wanted to keep the narrative pretty, you know, it's already an amorphous, how do you describe a battle that started in MacArthur Park in Los Angeles 40 years ago that's killed tens of thousands of people across, you know, six, seven countries now.
Right. And many years. Yeah, right, right. It's also interesting, we were talking about this before, about threat profile, where the threats are coming from, and the threats are often not coming from the places that you would most predict them to come from, right? That you go out on these SWAT raids that sound kind of terrifying to the average citizen sitting over here, and you were fine, and then you realize you're sitting in a coffee shop talking to somebody and you're on somebody's profile. So it's interesting to hear about where the real threats are and when you think you're safe and when you actually aren't quite as safe as you thought you were.
Yeah. It's always tricky to figure out just because I don't, you know, you walk around the corner on one of these raids and you get shot and then one of these guys in our unit had been killed 2 months earlier, turning a corner, doing the same sort of stuff that we were doing. I think, so you never know where it's coming from. The more I felt that I was understanding what was going on behind the scenes, that's when I did start to feel like I was more dangerous or more of a threat than, you know, usually as a sort of clueless foreign correspondent stumbling around like I am most of the time. You know, you're more trouble to people dead, you know, than you are alive. So that protects you a little bit, you know. I did feel a little bit more aware of my own threat profile the more I talked to people like you're saying who were under surveillance or, you know, were giving me information that would be a threat to powerful people.
I really appreciated our conversation. We were talking earlier about how you don't like, and, you know, foreign correspondents like you who go into kind of these dangerous situations don't like the identification that you are a danger-seeking journalist and that, you know, you tend to be maybe even more conservative in your decision-making, very calculated in your risk-taking. And I just thought that was very interesting because we, you know, with the some of the journalists that you hear doing these, you're like, oh my gosh, you're under so much pressure and in so many dangerous situations. And so to hear you say, we don't like to identify like that, I thought was interesting and just shed a new perspective on kind of how you approach your reporting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a maturity thing more than anything, you know. I think when you're young, you know, you take a lot of risks. And I think the people who the few people who stay in this game, you know, and do it well are the people that you want to emulate and respect and admire. And those people make very, try to think about risk and manage it in a way that's more conservative, at least I do. I mean, I think it's different for, you know, people who live in a war zone and you're on covering the Middle East full time, or, you know, the photographers, those guys have it. They're kind of always on the front line getting shot at. As writers, we just don't have to do that, and it rarely serves our narrative. You know, it's somewhat easier to manage risk and to sit back and get better stuff that way.
I hadn't even thought about the photographers. Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point. This would make a great documentary. Have you thought about doing this as a documentary? Because you're...
Maybe as a scripted, I think. You know, I don't want to go back there for a little while, but... but yeah, maybe something scripted, I think.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Well, let's shift our focus a little bit to the nitty-gritty writing parts. And a lot of stuff came out of everything you were just saying about writing choices in this. And I kind of wanted to give a shout-out. I wasn't completely aware of Columbia Global Reports before this, but these are kind of 200-page, 150-page small books that deliver an incredible amount of detailed information easily. So it's you know, longer than an Atlantic article, but it's not as overwhelming as, you know, a big biography on Hamilton or something. So it's a really nice way, I think, for people who are curious but not wanting to be overwhelmed by information to get great information. They've done like a bunch of these.
They say understanding globalization one short book at a time.
That's great.
That's kind of
I like that topic.
They're bite-sized, you know?
Yeah, they're bite-sized. Yeah. Right. So as you were talking about trying to figure out how to organize all the information, as you say, you know, it's spread over several countries, it's spread over decades. There's a lot of competing factions in here. And you don't know how sophisticated your audience is. So I don't know if you can kind of have a generalized conversation on how you whittle down this information and deliver it in sort of, you know, succinct, interesting, not overwhelming, but not treating your audience like idiots, but also not assuming they have a lot of knowledge they might not have. Like, I don't know if you have.
Yeah. I don't think I've figured that out. I wrestled with that question.
You delivered it beautifully. I was saying to you, I just thought this was very accessible for somebody who, you know, in my position, who doesn't have a lot of knowledge about this area or these countries or MS-13 beyond, you know, the terrifying stuff that you kind of...
I think that says more about your appetite than it does about the quality of the writing. My mother didn't agree with that. She thought it was a little bit complicated. But, I think characters, right? Like, that's a simple answer, is you find people who are interesting and can kind of hold your hand and serve as a guide. And then as long as you're, you know, following interesting people will, your audience will put up with a lot, I think.
Yeah.
I started with Israel Tikas, who's a sort of eccentric figure in El Salvador and famous. He's the lone forensic criminologist, kind of a CSI figure who goes out and digs up these bodies and tries to document what's happening in the country, and it makes him a target of the gangs. And he, even more so than I gave voice to in the section there, he like is, you know, he's irate with the powers that be in El Salvador and sees this very much as, you know, neither the two parties that were the warring parties in the war, the left-wing FMLN and the right-wing ARENA, you know, have governed over the dissolution of the country. Mm. And he sees the work that he does in finding these bodies as giving closure to the families. And he sees that, he sees very much as a sort of war in which the poor, like the Civil War, pay the ultimate price. And that it's the country's poor who are bleeding. And the elite from both of these, the former, you know, guerrilla fighters as much as the right-wing government, no one cares, you know.
Yeah.
So I think you load as many interesting characters as you can. I ended up telling it chronologically. If I were going to tell this again, I would tell it differently, probably.
Hmm.
I think if this was the movie version, it would start with...
President Trump.
less oxygen for him, probably. Yeah. I think we'd start with Guillermo Rivas drops his daughter off at preschool early one morning in April, and for some reason goes back to his house. And when he does, he's surprised by an unknown assailant who, according to forensics, you know, follows him throughout the house, plugging bullet after bullet into his body. And in Rivas's dying moments, he rolls over and whips out the small revolver that he's been carrying and shoots his assailant dead. And the boy, how do I say this carefully? And according to at least one of my sources, the military intelligence officer who was responsible for overseeing this operation finds that the whole operation's been blown, that the local police have surrounded the house, and that either Guillermo Rivas or his attacker, one of them is alive and he doesn't know which one.
Mm-hmm.
And everything hinges on, you know, who's which alive one. And can tell the tale. I think that's probably where I would have started the story, you know, if I were to do it again now. But I think telling it chronologically, because it was such a sprawling thing,
right,
was also sort of an easy fix.
Well, and the opening is very engaging. I mean, you can't, as you start reading this, which I encourage you to do, you can't look away very quickly. So, yeah, any of those I think would be great way to open. And we talked about this earlier before, too, and I assume this is common in journalism, although who knows in journalism anymore what's common, but entering into each story with absolutely no preconceived notions and allowing the data to even change your mind versus changing the reader's mind is obviously the goal, I guess, but or maybe not changing their mind, but informing them. And, you know, you start to wonder with journalism being where it is now, and you almost have to put journalism in quotes in some of the situations. How many people are doing that, just sticking to that journalistic integrity of, you know, not advancing their own agenda and just reporting what the facts are. Maybe you're a dying breed.
I mean, I do think it's a function of, like, I think some of the best journalism, the history of journalism is being done right now, you know. Mm. I think we know more and more about what's happening, particularly in our own society, but around the world maybe. Than ever before. That's sort of the maddening part in some ways.
Yeah.
The people who choose, the appetite for that might not be what it once was. To do foreign reporting for a U.S. audience, I do think is tough. And I think questions about appetite, questions about resources. And I think there was a period I remember early on in my career when I was trying to figure out how to tell these stories. There's a real learning curve, you know, to do it well. I'm still on. But, I remember when my conception of the story ran aground of some unforeseen fact or element, and I remember when that was sort of troubling. Mm. And I've kind of learned to, when I have those moments, to think, oh, this is actually great. This is an opportunity. There's something really interesting going on that I didn't expect. How do I pivot and understand this better and represent that, you know, and to do so in an interesting way? So I think it's, if you've got the time to do the work, then I think, you know, those moments are illuminating.
It's almost like science, yeah. Right? How a scientist would approach an experiment.
Right. Exactly. Right. Walter Lippmann was one of the sort of early 1920s, you know, not theorists, but advocates in journalism of using the scientific method. And it didn't mean that there was true objectivity. It meant that you questioned your own biases and subjectivities and tried to reckon with those.
I thought I was being original. I was not.
Standing on the shoulders
of giants.
Yeah,
right. Right. in this reporting, were all of the kind of arrows pointing in the same direction as you were interviewing gang members versus investigators versus, like, were there kind of inconvenient truths that you came across that you're like, oh, you're just blowing up my whole book right now?
I would say that there was, the truth thing really threw me. You know, to try to reconcile with that and to question the extent that I wanted to was tricky. But I'd say in general, like I kind of found, yeah, somebody says, I don't remember who a journalist says, was it Languisha, who says that when you you go and you're in the learning phase and you are learning all the time. And when you get to the point where your sources don't understand why something happened, but you are in the teaching phase, you know, you've talked to enough people that you know, then that's when it's time to start writing.
Hmm.
I had a few of those moments where gangsters, where gang members or police, homicide investigators or gang experts were all saying the same thing. That I really started to listen, you know. I think there was definitely this sense, and I remember it when the guy that I call Cesar said it to me, where he said, here's a guy who had joined Barrio 18, and was one of the first guys sort of hardened by this mano dura, the war that the state waged against the gangs. And he said that he copped everything he'd done, you know, all the people he'd killed. He told me the number of people he'd killed, how he did it, why he did it the way he did it. But in the end, he said, you know, I own the responsibility for who I've become. You know, I knew kids in my neighborhood who became doctors and lawyers, you know, even though they came from the same marginalized neighborhoods that I did. But he said, I also realized that the gangs are a really convenient scapegoat for everyone else in the society, and particularly the drug traffickers, the arms traffickers, the oligarchs, that we live in a society where there's a lot going on behind the surface. And the gang members are like the very convenient scapegoat for all that stuff. And, you know, I heard that as well from disillusioned police intelligence officers, you know, who had started to see this problem as cyclical and had had a peer, you know, had a window into what was really going on behind the scenes. So I think in that sense, yeah, I had people who were teaching me. And when I started to hear things that I would have from any one of them maybe discarded, but when I started to hear them from across the, you know, from the cops and the robbers, you start to pay attention. You know?
Right, right. I assume this is the longest form you've written in. So do you approach documentaries? I mean, I know you approach them differently, but, you know, article length pieces that you'd write for the New York Times versus this book versus a documentary. Like, is your thinking about how to, is the storytelling kind of the same? And then it's just the format of how you're delivering the information and how much space you have to do it? Or do you completely reconceive of how you would tell the story?
I think each outlet has their own, you know, somebody was talking about Harper's the first time you wrote a piece for Harper's, and it was like you sort of back into your subject with this anecdotal lead that like illuminates a bit of the history, and then you sort of back up even farther and sweep through the history and you have six scenes. And he'd been like an intern at Harper's, and when the editor said it was blown away, how did you write this piece? He said, well, there's, you guys have a formula, don't you know? And let me tell you what your formula is. So I think everyone has their own sort of style and approach. But I always think each piece has, ideally, has its own, you know, Michelangelo carving out the, you know, extraneous marble.
What's not
until,
there, yeah, right.
Working on Doc was, allowed me to really think about story in a very different way, because particularly these docs have been doing it for TV, and they're complicated, but they, like, adhere to a very established sort of story structure that's really different from the way that I would do it as a magazine writer. And you learn to appreciate each for its own. I mean, to go out in the field with just a notebook, you know, is such a blessing after, like, trying to get a camera into some illegal operation, you know. It's just a different, it's a different trade-off, you know.
That poor photographer. Not feeling so bad for the photographers, right. Are there other kind of journalistic tips and tricks? When we talked the last time, you put me on to, or I had heard of a book, but I hadn't really focused on it, The New Journalism, which is this Robert Boynton book about kind of conversations with nonfiction writers. So I'd love to hear, you know, if you feel like there are journalistic Bible sort of verses that you follow, you know, kind of things that have served you well of how to put together a narrative. I feel like you always start with the 16 thing is very interesting to me. I'm going to have to think about that more. But, you know, kind of start with the engaging anecdote that kind of sums up what you're trying to talk about, and then back into the information. But whatever you can share with us about journalism.
Yeah, I mean, I think Boynton's, you know, like, find people who do. I was working at the Orange County Register, and there was a guy, Michael Coronado, who I liked a lot. I liked his byline. and he'd been deployed to Iraq for some other newspaper. I was like, how'd you do it? And he said, well, I just took I took templates. I took like the best war correspondence that I loved, and I like printed those out and I carried them with me. I was always reading them, you know? So I think, yeah, standing on the shoulders of giants, you kind of find who you like and how they did it. Long form podcast people listen to. I think Boynton's book is really good because he asked the same questions in a lot of ways to William Languisha or Gitalise or Susan Orlean or Adrienne Nicole Blanc. Like, I think there's and you realize how different all of their processes are.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it's up. I mean, there's as many processes as there are journalists, and so there's no right way or wrong way, and it's liberating, I think, in that way. But you kind of borrow from, you know, I think Gatelise, I remember he like assembles his lead, each word of his lead he prints up on like an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper and like tapes them to the wall and then lies on the ground with a binocular and a pillow, like looking through the binoculars and reassembling his lead. And that's kind of the Gatelise method. I don't know. Yeah, I
have all these listeners going out to buy binoculars. It's good.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, warm baths seem to work for me. I think.
How long did this book take?
That book took, it's tough to say. I reported it over about a month of visits. And then I did a lot of reading and research on the back end, too.
Yeah.
So I worked on it for the better part of a year. But in fits and starts and stages, you know.
Yeah. It also feels like it would be easy to get, I mean, this is really true in huge books, but it'd be easy to lose the forest from the trees, kind of, you know, what have I told and how have I told it? And, you know, once you read things over and over and over, you kind of lose the thread of what you've said. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Or there's parts, too, where you're like, you know, when you're making sense of the, to go between the macro and the micro was
right.
Tough. And so I use these vignettes from these gang members at different times and from police different times of the problem's evolution. And you're reinterpreting their stories in light of your sort of framework. Like, as I started to understand what was really going on behind the truce, it made Carlos, what he had told me, I realized, oh, this is actually what this looks like on the ground as a result. When the gangs have been given access to military training, that's why this paramilitary attack outside your checkpoint happened the way that it did. You know, so there's a middle part of the process where you're lost and you're piecing things, your mind is piecing things together in new ways, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. From the reader's side, you know, as we've been alluding to all the way through the interview, we're just in such a precarious place in journalism, where we were talking about this earlier, where obviously confirmation bias is a huge problem. They have plenty of information. Information isn't the problem. And I don't think people's ignorance is exactly the problem. I think it's a confirmation bias problem and not feeling maybe as though, you know, you've got kind of administrations working against journalists, you know, talking about you being the enemy of the people and whatnot. Kind of what do you see as your biggest obstacles for breaking through some of that? And kind of do you have, you were talking about documentaries being kind of the new frontier of storytelling and getting information out, but kind of where do you see journalism heading in the next 10 years?
Boy, that's such a...
Well, that's a hard question.
That is a hard question. I don't... You know, I was just out at Sundance and they had, you know, this new company that's investing so much in like short docs and the like less than 11 minutes docs that you can watch on your phone, in line at the grocery store. and the technology get into the place that like you can do some really interesting things in that format. My girlfriend is at The Atlantic. She's the executive producer there. And they've really like, I think in my opinion, like, mastered the short doc format at 17 minutes. These beautifully crafted and moving pieces that still explain the world to you and can be investigative. So I think there might be some truth to that. On the other hand, you know, the push so far right now is to make your docs look more like features. And so, you know, I just worked on this series Did I just bump the mic?
You're all good.
Okay. I worked on the series that we spent, you know, a year and a half on, and we had three teams. One was with the smugglers coming out of Honduras, one was with law enforcement trying to stop them, and one was with families getting deported, you know, to sort of capture the cycle of migration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's with this director, Matthew Heineman, who did Cartel Land and is now doing features like Private War. So I think people right now do want the big sweeping visuals and either the access to take you into another world, mm-hmm. and immerse you in it completely, somewhere you wouldn't expect a camera to go, or to explain to you. I do think we're also in a great moment for explanatory journalism. I think the world is facing such a period of change that anyone who can sort of make sense of it, yeah. There is a premium on that. And I'm totally dodging your answer to the question.
No. That's helpful.
I don't know which way it's going.
Well, and it strikes me that people might be more interested in believing the truth if it's delivered through, I don't know why this is true, but it feels true, delivered through visual and auditory ways as opposed to reading it in print.
I think so.
I don't know why that's true, but visual features.
Creatures.
Right, yeah.
And I think, maybe it's, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, I definitely think that we need to, as storytellers, break out of, especially in journalism, break out of the received way of doing things.
Yeah.
I don't think that's working. At the same time, like, you know, when you had that monopoly on advertising revenue that the turn of the century newspaper had, you could unspool things a bit at a time and more information would come forward, almost like Serial did as a podcast, right?
Right.
And so there's something beautiful to that. And I worry that the more we expect our news to be entertaining or to make sense of it all and to be, you know, explanatory in that way, I think people are getting a little bit spoiled too. Like, it's a messy world and trying to make sense of it is incredibly difficult. I like the Daily's podcast, the New York Times, because they try to go into that process of, you know, here's what the sausage factory looks like.
Right. And deliver kind of unique new information. It's great. Mm-hmm. Can you believe we're out of time?
Are we? Well,
I know, right?
That raced by.
Any last minute advice? Something we should have covered that we didn't cover? Anything?
Support your local journalists.
There you go. Support your local bookstore. So Bill's going to be there tonight, 5 o'clock at Laguna Beach Books. So if you are out and about, you want to hear more about this, meet Bill and get your book signed. Laguna Beach Books, 5 o'clock tonight. We can follow you I know you're on Twitter, William G. Wheeler. And what is that, the best?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. I think I'm Bill Wheeler 1980 on Instagram. Those are both good ways.
You're having a birthday, too. Speaking of 1980.
Yeah.
It's a big birthday coming up for Bill. All right. Fair enough. That is all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day. And stay tuned for Orion's Belt on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.